This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Claire McDonnell and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Woman's Hour. Following on from Dame Esther Ranson's calls for a free vote in Parliament on assisted dying after she revealed her stage 4 lung cancer had led her to sign up with a Dignitas clinic in Switzerland, today we'll hear from former Labour MP Dame Joan Ruddock. She says she considered ending the life of her terminally ill husband, Labour MP Frank Doran, with a pillow because she could no longer bear to see him in such extreme pain. Her testimony has been made to the Health and Social Care Select Committee inquiry. Delighted to say Dame Joan will join us in a few moments in her first broadcast interview. Actor and comedian Catherine Parkinson has graced our screens for almost two decades, from The IT Crowd to Humans. She joins us to talk about her comedy drama Significant Other, about a midlife messy love story between two lonely neighbours. Here's a question. Are you in the midst of negotiating care for an elderly relative? Maybe they have dementia, which is tricky enough. But what about the negotiations that go on between siblings about who does the care and what kind of care a relative should receive? We have experts in the studio with us today to help you navigate that. So do get in touch with your questions. Also, Vanessa Chan was a high-flying communications director at Facebook, but the pandemic, her mother's death, and a growing weariness of being stuck in meetings with what she describes as tech bros, well, she decided to change tack and write. It has paid off in spades. Her debut novel, The Storm We Made, has ended up being in a seven-way publisher bidding war. And Vanessa will join us live from New York. And have you returned to something you loved when you were younger? We're going to hear from hockey player Steph Daniels, who returned to the sport after a 40-year hiatus and even made it to trials for England's over-70s squad, reigniting former passions. What have you gone back to? Do tell me. You can text the programme. The number is 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we are at BBC Woman's Hour. And you can email us through our website, or you can send us a WhatsApp message or voice note using the number 03700 100 444. Look forward to hearing from all of you listening this morning. Now, you may have seen the candid admission by the former Labour MP and Government Minister Dame Joan Ruddock that she was ready to end her terminally ill husband's life using a pillow in a bid to end his pain. Dame Joan's husband, Frank Doran, had been suffering from end-stage bowel cancer in 2017, and she struggled to get him pain relief medication in the hours before he died. She's now called for a free vote in the Commons to legalise assisted dying. Now, the public debate around the subject has been revived, of course, in recent months by leading figures such as Dame Esther Ranson, who revealed that she was considering travelling to a Dignitas clinic in Switzerland if her cancer worsens. And of course, the late Dame Diana Rigg, who made a recording before her death making the case for assisted dying. Delighted to say Dame Joan Ruddock, in her first broadcast interview about the subject, joins us now here on Woman's Hour. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for agreeing to talk about this, because an incredibly painful moment in your life, but one that you want to use, in your view, for the betterment of other people. Let's go back to what life was like when you were caring for your husband.
Which phone for Joan Ruddock, mobile or home?
I think we just got a little interference on the line there. You probably got a message coming through, but I think you're just switching that off, which would be great for the purposes of this interview.
Absolutely
fine. That's new technology for you. What did you hear the question? It's just
I did hear the question.
Talk us through what was life like? Yeah, looking after your husband.
It changed over 12 months when we had a diagnosis. Obviously, it was a great blow. We just retired. We were looking forward to a different kind of life after Parliament, but we were hopeful. To be honest, I heard the words palliative care when the consultant made the diagnosis, and I realised that meant there didn't expect to be a cure. My husband didn't take it in, and so he always remained entirely optimistic that whatever happened, however much suffering with the chemo, it was inoperable, actually. The way forward was to do the best, to do everything they asked of us, and we would get through it. But it changed as he became more and more sick and chemo failed. And ultimately, I became a full-time carer.
And how quick was that decline?
It goes in peaks and troughs, as people who have gone through this know. Sometimes the chemo is giving some relief and it goes on well enough. But I think, you know, for the last 3 months, I couldn't leave his side.
And the striking bit of testimony to the Health and Social Care Select Committee, who have been running an inquiry on assisted dying, is the moment, the hours before his eventual death, when he was in extreme pain. Can you take us back to that night?
Indeed. What was happening was I had Macmillan nurses coming in, and he was already on a permanent morphine drip into the body, and his pain was under reasonable control, but everything else had gone. I mean, people don't seem to realise that there's double incontinence, there's this constant distress about the condition, the physical changes are so awful for both parties in this, and so there's really a very, very difficult period. And again, something I hadn't been warned about is that he lost the ability to communicate. So he would try to speak to me. Obviously, he wanted to say things, but the words were completely in a jumble and couldn't be dealt with. So no palliative care deals with that. But at least the pain was going to be under control. They gave him an injection in addition to the constant morphine. And I asked, how long will this last? Because by this time he was groaning in agony, and they said it would last for 5 hours, and indeed he went well for the first few hours. I said, what time will you come back, because this is going to be 1 in the morning. They said, oh no, we go off duty at 10. So, you know, I was faced with this total horror. I knew my husband wanted help to die. We'd always talked about it, but he hadn't given me precise consent because he couldn't any longer speak to me. And I think he was obviously terribly worried about the consequences for me. So after I heard this information, I tried to get the Macmillan people who were coming at night, the carer who stayed overnight, not with us, but in a separate room. But she was a person who couldn't administer. So I then called the out of hours doctor service. It wasn't the sort of thing they normally did. I was able to give them the name of the drug that was used for the injections. Ultimately, after I said to them, either you come or I will end his life. I didn't know what the consequences are, but I will do it. And eventually they came, and eventually they gave it an injection, which resulted in his dying 7 hours later.
It's people listening to this will, and many people listening to this will have gone through something similar, to be pushed to that point. To, you had a pillow in your hand, didn't you?
You thought it through. I picked it up. I asked myself, what will I have to do to ensure that if he struggles, I can maintain the pressure, because it has to be ended.
Did you talk to him about it, or was he in no fit state to really communicate?
No, because he could no longer speak. And what I said to him when he kept trying to speak, which was some considerable days before this event. It had gone on for some days, and I simply held him and said, "We don't need to speak anymore, but I'll always be with you." And I was.
Thank you so much for talking about this. I appreciate it's incredibly difficult to go through, but it goes to the heart of what we're discussing today. When he was still able to communicate, well, you just said that he had expressed his wish to have control over his own death. He had talked about that.
I can't go on living like this. He was a skeleton. He was doubly incontinent. He had to be helped to get to a commode. And finally, in the last couple of weeks, he was totally bedridden, wearing napkins. This was a vigorous, funny, intelligent, marvelous man. Reduced to this condition, I think most people would probably wish for their lives to end. And I think at the moment, polls are showing about more than 80% of people actually want this choice. It's not about forcing people. It's not about people giving permission for people like me to end somebody's life. Of course not. That's a criminal offence. But to have the choice, to have the choice.
To get into those figures, there was a YouGov poll in 2021 that said almost three quarters of Britons, 73%, think the law should be changed to allow doctors to assist in the suicide of someone suffering from a terminal illness. But that figure changed when it was a personal choice and somebody wasn't terminally ill. That figure went down. So Britons tended to support allowing doctors to assist in the suicide of someone suffering from a painful, incurable, but not terminal illness. That dropped quite significantly. 16% support, 51% opposed. We're getting into the weeds of it now, and this is the entire issue. So what are you calling for? I know you've given this very personal testimony to the Health and Social Care Select Committee's inquiry. What change do you want to see?
I want to see it possible to have a system which is now operating in quite a number of countries across the world, starting with Oregon in the US, but now in European countries as well, whereby a doctor, or you maybe two doctors, have to make a decision that somebody is, you know, fully in their right mind and they know what they want to do, and that their life is going to end anyway. I mean, this is the point. And normally, this is life which is expected to end within 6 months, and that at that point, then there could be a choice and a means of medically supervised means of ending the life. We're looking at anything terribly dramatic, probably taking a small glass of a particular drug cocktail, and under supervision. And this seems to me to be entirely humane. And, you know, the shocking thing is that people in Britain have this kind of thing done to their pets all the time. You know, they cannot bear to see a pet suffer, but we allow, you know, human beings to suffer terribly.
I will just put the arguments to you, which I'm sure you've heard many times before, because I know you were involved in debates on assisted dying before your late husband became ill. The All-Party Parliamentary Group for Dying Well stands against the legalisation of assisted dying. Instead says we should promote access to excellent care at the end of life. Huge strides have been made in palliative care. And also the chair of that committee, Danny Kruger MP, said on X recently that all experience shows legalising assisted dying is dangerous for the most vulnerable. So what do you say to that kind of criticism, that vulnerable people could well be taken advantage of? Sheila Collins, a crossbench peer, opposes assisted dying as well, warning that the lives of autistic people, for example, and those with Down syndrome risk being less valued. How do you safeguard that in the law that you want to see?
As I say, I think it's very clear that there has to be great supervision in this. There have to be very tight laws. People have to be in the right, you know, have the right mental ability to make a decision. And indeed, you know, the decision is tested by experts. So I think the safeguards are there. And if we're absolutely honest, there is nothing in this world which is 100% safe. There are risks in everything. And it would be wrong to say there is no risk. But I think the risk is very, very small indeed. And what we do know is that already some compassionate doctors are ending people's lives without a change in the law. So, you know, we ought to be honest. And I say to members of parliament, look at what the public wants. Whatever your own views, really have some regard, have some compassion. Let us have a choice.
Thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour. We really appreciate you talking to us for the very first time about something so personal. I know it will touch many people listening today. That is Dame Joan Ruddock. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in that interview, there is information and support available on our website. And of course, we love to hear from you on this issue too. 84844 is the text number that you need. Many of you are getting in touch already, but keep your text coming in, 84844. Now, let's move on to talk to one of the great comic actresses of our time, Catherine Parkinson. She's graced our TV screens for almost two decades, from Doc Martin to The IT Crowd to Humans and the brilliant Here We Go. And now she has a comedy drama airing on ITV called Significant Other, in which she plays one half of a rather odd couple, neighbours who meet in highly unusual circumstances. I'm delighted to say Catherine joins me in the studio now. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in. I've seen quite a lot of this series. It's absolutely brilliant. It's been on ITVX, the streaming platform, for quite a while, but it's now going on terrestrial TV. Your character is Anna. The setup is quite extreme, the way it starts. So for people who haven't seen it or are looking forward to seeing it on ITV terrestrial channels, tell us about it.
It is quite an extreme setup, quite an arresting beginning. It's my character Anna is having a heart attack, and her next door neighbour, who she's never met or spoken to, has taken lots of pills to end his life, and has written a letter to his a little note to his ex-wife to say, look what you made me do. And and he lies down, waits for the pills to kick in, and then there's a knock at the door, and it's me, it's Anna, and she's been told by the ambulance that she mustn't be alone. She needs to be with somebody until the ambulance comes. And that's the meet cute. That's how they...
that's one way of describing it.
That's how the beautiful romance begins. And they end up sharing the same ambulance.
Yes, it's brilliant. It finds humour in various very serious subject matter. Was that a you know, to start in such a dark place kind of sets the tone for all of it. Why were you drawn to it?
I was drawn to it instantly when I read the script. So it's based on an Israeli show that was a big success, written by Dana Modan and who starred in it as well. And I think the difference struck me because it doesn't feel like a British script that I've read. And I think I just loved how unexpected it was. I mean, there are moments like, you know, when they finally do sort of respond to an undeniable connection that they have that they're both trying to ignore, and they do sort of get together, they don't know what to sort of say to each other, and then Sam gets up and gets a Henry Hoover out and just hoovers. Things like that I found extremely funny because there was a truthfulness and an unexpectedness, and it's that sort of laugh it engenders. It's not a laugh a minute gagathon. It's a tender but ultimately quite very hopeful show, I think, where two people in midlife who have been battered about and are a bit obsessed with their sort of damaged relationships in the past, somehow their connection sort of overcomes everything.
Yes, and the darkness also touches on the loneliness of your character and his character too. It's an important part of the programme, isn't it? What loneliness does to people.
Yes, and I think specifically a sort of urban loneliness, you know, when, you know, loneliness is a crowded room and all that, and they're in this kind of huge building with lots of people living very close to each other, but Anna works from home and I mean, the only person she might see sometimes is the guy she buys all of her junk food off. And there's a nice poetry, I think, to the show. You know, she's literally heart sick. She's got heart disease at 45. And I remember after we made the show, it was actually in the papers that loneliness can cause heart disease. And and then there's some other bits of poetry where she sort of, he gets the keys to her flat and unlocks her heart. You know, I loved the way that was lightly done, but it felt, you know, beautifully poetic.
It certainly is. Let's have a little clip. This is Anna discussing her recovery and indeed her heart with her doctor.
About the...
Yes?
The activity.
Physical activity, yeah, crucial.
No, the other one.
Sexual activity.
Yes.
What about it?
When you say it's recommended, let's say, I mean, I don't know, if I hadn't done it in, you know...
A few weeks?
Yeah.
That's totally natural, Anna.
Yeah. Or, let's say, months. Or... years. Is it still recommended?
Absolutely. Even more so. Because after all, that could be the reason why you're here.
You think?
Yes. If, as is often the case, loneliness is an issue, then, yeah, it can be a decisive trigger.
You can get a heart attack from loneliness.
But where do we feel the loneliness? In our bodies. Bingo.
And at that point, Anna's put her hand on her heart, hasn't she? It's sort of gut-wrenching to hear. Did it make you reflect on lonely periods in your own life? How did you tap into that aspect of her life?
Yes, it did. It did, absolutely. I think what I kept reminding myself playing Anna was that she doesn't feel sorry for herself, and that there's a nobility in that. And I think that's also often the case, because it's only retrospectively that I've thought about lonely times, because I certainly didn't think I was lonely when I was a student and only eating from the chip vans and you know, sort of speak. I used to actually talk to my bicycle, which I think is
did it have a name?
Not normal. I don't think it did have a name. But
you're sane then.
But you know, I think that probably most of us, by the time we get to a certain age, have had lonelier periods. And I think that what that scene that you played, what makes it particularly sort of humiliating for her is that he's such an attractive man, an attractive doctor, and she's quite proud, you know, and certainly wouldn't want anybody to think she was a lonely person. And sometimes that's the problem, and that's why you can't fight out of your loneliness, because you're defensive about making connections, which I think applies to Anna.
Yeah, I mean, what struck me was, I know actors often talk about the honesty about approaching roles and portrayal, but it's so poignant, isn't it? That it's an honesty that they eventually have with one another that sort of leads to happiness. Do you think we often cloak that loneliness and are so worried about what other people might think, that actually that can be very damaging to us personally?
Yes, absolutely. And I feel like their connection, it has its own life and sort of overcomes them both. They're sort of, I think what was enjoyable as an actress was playing these scenes real time, where there were lots of pauses, and that they will be saying one thing and Sam will be putting his foot in it and saying the wrong thing. But I think there's a different story told in their eyes when they're looking at each other. And I think that's the wonderful thing. The powerful connection between two people can sometimes overcome all the sort of annoying behaviours and saying the wrong things. And, you know, he might not sort of tell her she's beautiful and all the rest of it, but she can see in his eyes that they've got a very real and honest connection.
That's because you're such great actors. That's the thing about it. You're allowed the time to do that. It really, really is very, very, very gratifying to watch that. Let's talk about, you know, you're no stranger to comedy sitcom format. You won a BAFTA for playing Jen in The IT Crowd. And that became a bit of a cult classic, didn't it? Especially with lockdown, for the younger generations. What does that feel like?
Yes, I've heard that from my agent because I don't have much communication with the younger generation. But then what happens is people approach you on the street for something you did 20 years ago and you feel extremely grateful they still recognise you, because I think there probably have been some physical alterations for me.
You're so hard on yourself.
But I'm very pleased that a studio sitcom has found, has got what they call a long tail and has found this sort of longer life. I haven't done a studio sitcom for a long time and I'm a fan of them. My daughters love watching American ones, and I'm you know, a fan of not going out and things. And I think studio sitcoms are unfairly maligned sometimes in this country, perhaps. And there's a real buzz to doing them.
I'll bet, just to have that live audience there. That's one of the great things about not going out, isn't it? You hear that instant reaction. It brings it to life.
Absolutely. And when you do a long-running a play with comic elements in the theatre, you have the privilege of working out exactly how to place a line and exactly how to do a joke, and it just evolves and gets better. And I think you have a chance at doing that in studio sitcoms because you've got the live reaction.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you, actually, about where you feel we are as far as female writing and female-led dramas, especially comedy dramas. We've got great writers like guys Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Michaela Cole as well, leading the charge at the moment. How much has that changed since you got involved in this game?
I think it's changed hugely, and it's so exciting, and I feel lucky to be just about young enough to be benefiting, actually, because one of my most favourite writers is Laura Wade. And, you know, I really do enjoy interpreting her writing because she's a woman a similar age to me. And of course there's a shared sensibility. And I sometimes feel like we're the same on the inside. And that means there's a very close sort of working relationship where I feel like she knows what I'm going to do almost before I do it with her writing. And when I started out, I didn't really do female writers. I did a lot of new writing in the theatre, but it was men. And I feel absolutely excited by it and slightly ashamed not to have done more writing myself.
Still time,
yeah.
But just to squeeze in, I could talk to you for ages, but we have to plough on. You are going to be in an adaptation of Gilly Cooper's The Rivals.
I am,
which is a bit of raunch.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So can you give us any insights?
Oh, my goodness, it's a bit of a raunch. And it was an unbelievable blast to make with a very big and very fun cast. It's an 8-part series for Disney Plus. I absolutely loved it. And I have a romance, more than just a raunch, but a raunch too, with Danny Dyer, which, is obviously a gift from heaven.
It's a great way to start the new year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in. Significant Other starts this Sunday, January the 7th, 10:15 p.m. on ITV1. Catherine Parkinson, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Lots of you getting in touch on a lot of the subjects we've talked about already this morning. Dame Joan Ruddock earlier talking about assisted dying and wanting it legalised in this country. I completely agree that there should be choice about how to end life for those with terminal illnesses. My husband died of pancreatic cancer last April. My family nursed him at home for 12 agonising weeks. The hospice at home can only do so much. And there were times when his morphine driver ran out and we had to wait hours for the nurse to come. Watching him deteriorate was agonising. He was skin and bones when he finally died, having not eaten or drunk for weeks. It is utterly inhumane. Lots more texts. I'll squeeze as many in as I can, but do keep in touch with the programme. This is the number you need, 84844. Now, let's move on to talk about something you may have missed on our New Year's Day programme. It was all about women and negotiation, from negotiating with a 5-year-old to put their shoes on, to negotiating with the in-laws, right up to negotiating resolutions to international conflicts. Hayley Hassel spoke to a range of women, including former Met Police hostage negotiator Nikki Perfect.
Across the whole of my career, I would say that I have always underestimated the power of listening. And I didn't really know how to listen. And that most of us listen from a perspective of, oh, I can't wait for my say in the conversation. I'd just like to give my point of view. Because we do have really strong points of views and opinions, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just recognising that we don't always need to give our opinion, and that sometimes people don't want to hear our opinion. I think it's really important, especially in family negotiations, especially when there's so much emotion in a family negotiation, is that you recognise that when you do become emotional, when you do start talking from that emotional perspective, just recognising the space that you're sitting in at the time. And do you need to just step out of that space for a bit before you come back?
Well, that was hostage negotiator Nikki Perfect. And you can hear more from Nikki and the other women negotiators on BBC Sounds and search for that edition of Woman's Hour on the 1st of January. Well, it certainly provoked a huge response, including one from one listener who contacted us on Instagram about her own family situation. Judy said this: "I would love you to cover negotiations between carers and their parent with dementia. Another world. As is negotiating between carer and siblings." Sadly, Judy has COVID at the moment, so get well soon, Judy. She can't join us today, but we are going to discuss the issue she raises with two experts in this field. Professor June Andrews, who's a fellow of the Royal College of Nursing and an author of Carers and Caring, and also Dr. Liz Bolton, Health and Care Manager at the charity Age UK. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's start by asking you, Professor June Andrews, about what Judy said, negotiating. It's negotiating with the person you're caring for, but also with other people in the family who might have different views on how that should be done. It's a bit of a minefield, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And in all the interactions that I have with people who want me to give them some help around dementia specifically, I find that I used to think that they were going to ask me about what dementia was like, about technical things to do with the neurology. But almost invariably, the question is about family dynamics and the pressure that exists upon the person who's the main carer from opinions expressed by siblings and a lot of the problems that are created because sometimes decisions have to be made under extremely difficult circumstances. For example, if one parent dies and you're grieving for that parent and having to make decisions for the other. And just at that moment, you're also in a position where with siblings who you may not have made an adult decision within your life, you're making some really important legal, sometimes financial decisions. Life is very difficult at that time. And we don't have the experience of having done this before, makes life difficult. The other sort of thing that people ask me about, of course, is when you've got a parent with dementia who it's hard to negotiate with. But in some ways, I have more solutions to that than I would have to the problem of working with siblings.
Is that just because it's basically the same family dynamics that there have always been, but now with a very thorny issue of a much-loved relative in the middle of it? I mean, I guess it is that, isn't it? It's that sibling rivalry maybe sometimes that you haven't moved beyond.
There might be sibling rivalry, but one of the things that we should think about, I had read somewhere that in reality, although we're siblings, although we share the same parents, we've not really been brought up in the same family. Some of us, for example, one family I'm working with just now, the oldest child in the family who's a carer and having to make decisions, she was the first child of a young couple living in a tiny apartment. The youngest sibling who's having to make decisions is a son who was born into a busy house, a middle-class house where both parents were working. So their childhood experiences and their relationship with their parents are quite different. There are also gendered differences with relationships. You know, dads expect daughters to do some things. Sons are, you know, horrified if they would have to do some things for their mothers. The negotiation about who does what isn't just about sibling rivalry and the history, although that obviously comes into it. A lot of it is about the fact that we have expectations and understandings about dementia and frailty that are quite different, that we've picked up over the course of our lives. Some family members may never have seen someone get frail and die before. Other family members may not understand what dementia is, may not recognise it, or at least have differing understandings of what it is. And so under those circumstances, with such a different background with each person and such a different relationship with the parent, it's really, really hard for people to agree decisions and make those decisions together. Well, sometimes it's just to step up and make the decisions.
Yeah, we'll come back to advice on how people can do that. But let's bring in Dr. Liz Bolton, Health and Care Manager at charity Age UK. Is a lot of this resonating with you, Liz? And what do you find is a good place to start working through this?
Yeah, absolutely. It did certainly rings true from my own experience as a carer, but also what we hear from carers at Age UK and what I know locally from my work as a trustee of a local carer support organisation. And at Age UK, we run polling and a survey for older people's health and care every year. And one of the topics we ask about is caring for others. And when we look at the breakdown of who's providing care, we see that it's more often women. It's more often people aged between 50 and 59. And it's more often people living with their own long-term conditions. So there are lots of complex issues going on, I think, in caring relationships. And when you add in that relationship with your siblings, which, you know, as has already been stated, there might have been rivalry, there might have been difficulties in those relationships. But I think we really, really need to be careful not to fall into the trap of assuming that the female family members will automatically be the main carer. Because we hear from hundreds of women who are struggling to manage their caring responsibilities alongside their careers and their family relationships. And they talk about how the impact on, you know, breaking down their own family relationships with husbands and children because of the demands on their time, the problems in getting ahead in their career, or even just having time to do their job. And I think, you know, there's kind of a historic thing here with gender assumptions. So when my brother and I set up Lasting Power of Attorney for our father a few years ago now, Dad assumed that I was going to look after all of his health and care needs and that my brother was going to look after all of his finances and housing, because those are the two separate forms that you have to fill in. And because I've worked in health and care for 28 years and because I work for Age UK and I know the system, it kind of does make sense for me to cover most of the health and care issues. But as those issues and needs increase, I think it's really important to come back and look at the balance again, because we're both working full time and we need to not make assumptions.
And is the key there? Have you already had that conversation with your brother to say, look, you know, that's his assumption, but it certainly isn't mine?
No.
Okay. Appreciate your honesty.
I think it is, because, you know, this is my area. This is my work area. This is what I know. So, you know, it's a lot easier for me to deal with these issues than it is for him. He would have the steepest learning curve to understand how the health and care system works, to be able to support Dad to get his needs met. Whereas for me, it's really simple. But I think, you know, one of the things we do is we keep a spreadsheet of contacts of who's doing what. And I think the time is coming to have a look at that and look at the balance of the responsibilities going forward.
That is a great idea, a spreadsheet, so you actually see where that balance of responsibility is. Let's bring in June Andrews again. June, I know you've actually identified two key areas of negotiations when it comes to talking about all of this within a family: crisis decisions and considered decisions. So talk us through what the difference is, if you could give us some examples.
So the key areas that everybody should think about in advance are areas of finance and areas of legal issues. So as someone, for example, becomes old and frail with dementia or gets an illness where they can't speak, which we heard about earlier on in the programme, it's important that something has already been set up to make decisions. I know you've had programmes about powers of attorney. And in that area, it's crucial that all the people who are listening now who haven't given power of attorney to anybody should do that now. You know, save this for the next generation. But if you're in a position where the person that you care for is already older and this has not been done, you've probably got some really difficult conversations you have to have before the person loses capacity to make those decisions. One of the areas that you might have difficulty with is, for example, if someone is starting to have dementia, one of the areas that people have most arguments about is questions of giving up driving. You may have two siblings, one of whom says it would ruin mum's life forever if you took her car away. And another one says, well, it would ruin her life if she had an accident and hurt other people. How do you make those decisions? One thing that the public guardian has said to me before is this is an area where there's a real problem if you have an even number of attorneys, because you don't have anybody with a casting vote and you have a real impasse where people can't make a decision. Another area might be the point at which you start to bring in external care that's not family care. because the care that women do is often like invisible mending, it's something that creeps up on you over a period of time. Nobody sees it. You're trying to stop the person being humiliated by anybody noticing all the things that you're doing for them. And some of them are so intimate that you wouldn't tell anybody, for example, that you'd had to clean your parent or clean your parent's toilet. All of those things creep up and they are invisible. And so at the point when that carer starts to be able to say, I really need help with this, all the other siblings, particularly the ones who for gender reasons haven't been involved in the care, might take some persuading that care is needed. And that's where a lot of difficulties come, because often that aging parent will side with the siblings who say, we don't need any help in this house, we're doing just fine. And it's because it's the invisible daughter sometimes, or daughter-in-law, who's quietly getting on with it at risk, as has just been said by Liz, to her family, to her personal relationships, to her work, and even to things like her future economics. Because if you don't press on at work, it affects your pension, it affects your promotion. You may have problems much later in your life because of the sacrifice that you have made at this point, and which you've had to make because nobody else realizes that it's time to get extra help.
So that's,
believe me,
sorry.
The majority of people don't end up in a care home. The majority of people don't need this kind of help. But in the places where it is needed, it's really important to be able to persuade other people when the time has come for extra help.
Yes, so the extra person and power of attorney is a good one with a casting vote. Final word to you, Liz. I guess what we're talking about is families trying to find a way through these difficult negotiations. What would be your final word of advice?
I would say when you're negotiating with family members, focus on staying calm, on how the imbalance is making you feel, rather than accusing others of not pulling their weight. So sounding non-judgmental and avoiding sounding too critical. And it's a really good idea to write down what you want to get across before you start the conversation. And as Nikki said in the previous programme, be open to understanding other people's point of view, because there might be a very good reason why they can't step up and do any more at the moment because of other issues that are going on in their lives. So I think you really need to create an open relationship where you can talk honestly with the others.
Great to have you both on the programme. Such an important topic. Dr. Liz Bolton there, Health and Care Manager at the charity Age UK, and Professor June Andrews, a Fellow of the Royal College of Nursing and author of Carers and Caring. Again, share your experiences, 84844 on the text number. Lots of you getting in touch on many of the topics we've covered so far. Unassisted dying, this texter, I've watched both my parents die in agony, as Dame Joan Ruddock described. Our palliative care services are not able to stop people dying in extreme pain. At the end of their life, we treat animals with more respect than humans, and something needs to change. And this texter, the answer is funding proper palliative care, medicines and staff, not legalising early death, which would quickly become a cost-saving exercise for our broken NHS. Thank you for your texts. Keep them coming in to the programme. Now, let's take you to Malaya, known to us today as Malaysia during the Second World War. A new book, The Storm We Made, is set in two timelines across British colonialism and Japanese colonialism, and follows housewife Cecily, who becomes an unlikely spy for a general, but her decision has huge repercussions for her and her family. It is the first book by debut author Vanessa Chan and was fought over in a seven-way auction from publishers here in the UK. Delighted to say Vanessa joins me now live from Brooklyn. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant to have you. And to have a seven-way bun fight over your first novel, were you expecting that?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't think anyone expects that. I was beyond shocked. I was actually in Malaysia when the auction was going on, and it was during the earlier part of the pandemic, where I was still under quarantine. When you had to, if you traveled somewhere, you had to quarantine somewhere. I was actually quarantining with my father, and when I came out of quarantine, the auction had closed and my life had changed.
Yes, and many things happened to you, didn't they, during lockdown? You had a lot of personal loss, didn't you?
Yes. I think like a lot of us, you know, the very early parts of the pandemic were very, very difficult. But for me, I was in New York City in April 2020 when when it was the epicenter of the pandemic. And during that time, both my mother and my uncle passed. And I, you know, at this time was trying to write a novel about about home, and I was trapped. I couldn't go home. I couldn't be with my dying mother, and it was an incredibly challenging moment of grief for me while I was trying to write this novel.
And I know obviously that's had a profound impact on you and how you approach the novel, but just to go back a little bit to what you were doing before you decided that you wanted to write, you'd scaled the heights. You were in Facebook, communications director of the company, hanging out with tech bros, which you write about rather amusingly, about how often it was just you and Sheryl Sandberg in meetings with however many Marks or Daves or Mikes. And you thought, I've had enough of this?
Exactly. That's a simple way of looking at it. But yes, I found myself frequently in meetings with a series of men with the same name and me and one other woman, you know, often Sheryl Sandberg. And I did that for 6 years. You know, I started as a manager and ended up as a communications director. And, you know, it was actually during this time that I switched immigration status from requiring a work visa to being getting residency, which was when I was no longer tied to an employer. And I was able essentially to freely pursue whatever it is I wanted. And I was stymied by this. I'd never had this freedom as long as I'd worked. I was always, you know, an immigrant who required a visa, who had to check her paperwork before she left the country, who worried about being told that my visa was expired or something had happened. And all of a sudden, I had this incredible freedom to do what I wanted. And it took me several more years to figure out what it is I wanted to do. And I decided it was time to write that novel that had been stewing inside of me for a while.
Well, you made the right choice. Let's talk about the book now. It's absolutely brilliant. The Storm We Made. It flicks between two time periods, the 1930s and the 1940s, between British-occupied Malaya and Japanese-occupied Malaya, with a central character, the main character of Cicely, and what she does to try and escape the domesticity of her life between the roles of mother, wife and spy. It's not often written about, is it, this period of the British occupation of Malaya and the Japanese occupation of Malaya? Why did you decide to make that the backdrop?
You know, growing up, I'd heard some of these stories from my grandparents and from other family members about the Japanese occupation. But like you said, our history books don't cover this period. And part of that is because, you know, our families are reluctant to talk about their trauma publicly. But part of it is just the nature of history is that Europe is centered, right? America is centered. And the Pacific theater of the Second World War is very much not covered in history books, in fiction. And it seemed to me like it was time. It was time that these stories that I'd had swirling in me, these stories that I'd been told, I laid them down on paper, because that's the only way that you create a history that hasn't been written. If you take the stories passed down through to you through time and lay them down somewhere so that other people can read them.
And especially from a female perspective, you talk about how your grandparents' generation didn't want to talk about it. Is that because of the brutality of it, of the brutality especially to women as well? You talk about comfort women in the novel too. Do you think there's a shame attached to that, or there's a desire just to not dig up a period of history that's so incredibly painful?
I think all of that is true. I think it was an incredibly brutal period of history. I think the common statistic is in 4 years of occupation, the Japanese killed more people than the British did in 50 years. This is not to say one colonizer is better than the other, but it was a terrible period of brutality, and a particularly brutal period for women, because girls as young as 7 or 8 years old were being kidnapped and recruited to work at comfort stations for Japanese officers. And
a comfort station, could you explain what that is?
A comfort station is a place where comfort women are essentially kept as prisoners of war to service Japanese soldiers. service their urges as they emerged. And the reason that these exist is because they did not want Japanese soldiers to go into cities to pillage and rampage. So they decided to build stations where women would be available to them. But at these stations, the women who were there were obviously not there by choice. They were kidnapped and kept, and used in the worst possible ways.
And some of them were children.
Many of them were children, because children do not get pregnant.
This book has been picked up by a publisher in Japan. Just a final thought on that. You say you the only way you kind of recreate a new history is to write it down. I mean, does that feel revolutionary to you, that this is now Japan wants to read your fiction, but read what actually happened?
It was an incredible shock to me. This book is, as you would expect, incredibly critical of Imperial Japan and what happened during the war. But we received an offer from the a Japanese publisher, who wrote me an extensive and touching letter that said, it is time for the Japanese people to learn about our history, not just from the perspective of soldiers going to the front, or from the perspective of Japanese people. It is time that the Japanese people learn what happened to other people because of Japan. And it was a shock and incredible revelation to realize that this book will be in the hands of Japanese readers who will be learning about their own history.
For the very first time, in many cases.
I think so. Very first time of the history of occupation and the way they changed the world.
Well, it's a brilliant read. It really is. And thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
Vanessa Chan is the author, and the book is The Storm We Made. And it is out now. Now, thank you for everybody who's got in touch. We've been asking you also about passions that you have returned to in later life. We're going to talk to somebody about that next. This texter, who is this from? This is from, bear with me, Kate in Birmingham. I bought myself a pair of beautiful ice skating boots for Christmas. I'm 45. I've always dreamt of becoming a figure skater, as I love ice skating. I don't think that dream is going to come true, but I thought, why not just buy the boots and skate a bit more? And I'm not sure whose permission I was waiting for, really. So I gave it to myself, and I couldn't be happier. It's definitely reignited my passion for skating. Kate, thank you so much for getting in touch. That's what we're asking you now. Have you reignited a passion for something you did earlier in life? What have you gone back to recently? How has it brought you joy? Steph Daniels gave up hockey in her mid-30s, but after seeing an advert for Bedford Hockey Club, she decided to pick up her sticks once more and has even attended trials for the over-70s England team. And Steph joins us now. Hello.
Hello, Claire. First of all, could I just say such moving stories today, particularly from Dame Joan Ruddock. And, dignity in dying is so important. But I'd also like to tell your listeners that there are lots of older people out there, women especially, doing exciting things, having fun and lots of energy.
Well, you're one of them, and that's why we have you on. So hockey, it was a big part of your life when you were younger, and you were a good player.
I was. Oh, well, I suppose like most school children in England, I started when I was 11 at school. Joined the club when I was 16, went on to play county hockey, Midland Juniors hockey, and played until I was about 35.
Okay, so why did you walk away from it?
Well, I was a former PE teacher, and anybody who knows a PE teacher, from the moment they get into school from 8 o'clock in the morning till they leave about 6 o'clock, you're so busy. At the weekend, there's school matches. After school, at the weekends, I was playing club hockey, county hockey, at weekends, tournaments, Easter holidays, Christmas holidays. And I thought, you know what? I think I want to do other things with my life. I don't just want my life to be about hockey, as much as I enjoyed it. So I thought, no, enough. Enough is enough.
Yeah, so the thing you had a passion for just started to feel like a chore.
It did. I wanted to go to the theatre. I wanted to go to concerts. I wanted to go away for weekends. And I had so little time before.
Yeah. So you took a break, quite a long break, and yes. You came back to it. So what was the impetus? What did you see? What caught your eye?
Well, I saw a picture in the local Bedford paper of an advert about walking hockey, and I'd never really heard about walking hockey. And I thought, oh, have I still got my stick? Would it still be the right shape? Could I still play? Would I still have my skill? So I thought I'd go along and see. And so it's a wonderful group. It's a wonderful community of walkers, men, women, all ages. And during the pandemic, it was a lifesaver for all of us because we could play outside, we could have fun, we could have contact with people and get fit. So the physical and mental health of walking hockey is fantastic. And the school level, the skill level. I mean, they say it's walking hockey, but people say I don't always walk, which is probably why I joined
Well, you went back to the running version, didn't you, for a bit?
I did. I'm still playing. In fact, I went to training last night.
Yeah, fantastic. And tell me about the kind of cross-generational aspect to this, because here you are, over 70, and people listening might think, oh, well, you're all in the same age bracket and you're all walking around the same pitch. It's not that, is it?
Oh, no. Well, the proper hockey last night, there were 12 of us and a coach, and I think seven of them were still at school, and five of us older ones, and I was the older one. So we've got 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and we've got people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and me.
How does that work, though, as a team?
Oh,
is it a bit chaotic?
Yes, it is at times because, you know, the kids, they love to dribble and they love to keep the ball. And so our team is kind of a development team. We're trying to move them on, teach them to pass the ball because it is a team game and not just keep it to themselves. And they do a lot of the running for us. Although we also run. And the banter, you know, at training last night, you hear about all the problems at school, not getting the homework in time. We talk about Israel and all the problems in the world. And it's just lovely to have this real mix of ages.
So anybody listening to this who has a passion that they've been thinking, I mean, we just heard a wonderful text from one of our listeners saying, I've bought roller skates. I don't know who I was waiting to get permission for to start roller skating again myself. What would you say?
Oh, go for it. I mean, that's the thought. I mean, I used to love roller skating. We just used to do it around the streets. But yes, I mean, not everybody's into sport. I mean, you can do music, you can join a choir. I mean, To do a team, something in a team, is so unusual for women. Once you leave school, most women don't ever play in a team again. So to play a team sport or be in an orchestra or a choir or just going down to the gym and being with other people, go for it. There's so many things women can do these days.
You're an inspiration, Steph, and I'm sure you've inspired many of our listeners this morning to do something, reignite that passion in something they love. Thank you so much for joining us. That is Steph Daniels, gave up hockey in her mid-30s, but she's back playing again in her 70s. That's it from Woman's Hour from today. Talk to you tomorrow. That's all from today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
From BBC Radio 4, life can be unexpected.
It was big. You know, this was not a wind, this was not a storm, this was a tsunami.
But when confronted with change, humans are remarkably resilient.
I knew in that moment as I fell to the ground that I would recover more.
I'm Dr. Sian Williams, psychologist and presenter of Life Changing, the programme that speaks to people whose worlds have been flipped upside down and transformed in a moment.
If I had to live my life again, would I ever want to go through what I went through? There's a very simple answer to that. I would go through it again.
Subscribe to Life Changing on BBC Sounds.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.